Good morning and welcome to Homefires Radio Show. I'm your host, Patty Kostelic. What we're about to hear is a conversation with Lydia Black that I had on February 16th. Due to a power failure, the radio station was off the air during most of that program. I think that the facts and information that Lydia shared with us about the Aleut relocation during World War II were interesting enough that I wanted to take the first opportunity I had to repeat that show. I also would like to bring to your attention the fact that the University of Alaska Museum is doing an Otto Geist lecture series on the Aleuts, and Lydia is taking part in that. I'm sure that if you would like more information, you could contact the University Museum. So without further delay, here is that conversation with Lydia Black. Good morning. Welcome to the Homefires Radio Show. I'm your host, Patty Kostelic, and I think I'm going to entitle this program this morning a conversation with Lydia Black. She's a visiting professor at the University of Alaska, and I'm going to let Dr. Black tell us about her background.
Well, I have become a specialist on Alaskan anthropology and also on the Russian period in Alaska in spite of myself. I was born in the Soviet Union, and I refused to return to the Soviet Union from Germany at the end of World War II. I was very young. I was 15 when the war broke out. I was barely, not yet 19 when the war ended. But my family was destroyed by the Soviet regime. My parents were dead. My father was presumably shot by the secret police. My mother died at the age of 36 in very horrible circumstances. I had no family left, and there was no life for me because I was a member of what in the Soviet Union is called antisocial elements. That is, people who can be expected not to support the regime. There were millions like me. And I knew very well that I had no future. My future would have been a concentration camp. And I married also a refugee from Russia, or the Soviet Union, I should say. And we came to the United States in 1950. My husband became a specialist in thermodynamics. He worked on the Apollo project. He received posthumously a commendation from the United States government for his contribution to the United States space effort. We had four lovely children, and I was very happy until 1969 when my husband died.
Where were you living all that time?
In Massachusetts. I come from a family where many of my people were scholars, and scholarship was something you did. You didn't go to school to become a scholar. You were a scholar. And I have been doing scholarship at home all my married life. So when my husband died, my older children, the eldest was just going off to college, they said, "Mother, don't take that job in the supermarket. You qualify yourself for what you do best." So I went to graduate school. And because of my linguistic knowledge and Russian ability, I was gently guided into anthropology of Siberia. When I received my PhD, naturally, I was asked to teach such subjects as cultures of circumpolar area. And when I got to Alaska, especially Aleutian Islands, I found that there was very little materials in English that were really worth reading by the students. And I began to prepare my lectures using materials, primary sources in foreign languages, Russian, French, German, and so on. And in about 2 years' time, I realized that I was doing research. And I decided that the time was ripe to see the place in the flesh, so to speak. I got a very small grant, summer stipend from National Endowment for the Humanities, and I went to the Aleutian Islands. And I got stuck.
And that year was 1975.
That's right.
Well, that's fairly logical and straightforward progression to an obscure place.
It became my love. And the more I stay in Alaska, the longer I stay here, the more often I visit, the more I feel I belong here.
I think that's true for many of us. It seems like it might only be a temporary thing, but it's not really easily comparable to any other place. And so if you fall in love with it, you may find that you're here to stay.
Well, I'm going to the Aleutians during spring break on the invitation of the Aleut community, and I feel like I'm going home.
Mm-hmm. You've done a great deal for them, and so I'm sure that it will be a kind of homecoming. We'll get to that in a minute. Is the group of colleagues whose specialty is circumpolar work in this area, is this a large field? Is this
it is
fairly
not
obscure?
It is not a very large field. The problem in the United States is that the academic enterprise is so structured that we are fragmented. Anthropologists do not communicate with historians, and neither of the two communicates with geographers or specialists in polar aviation or polar navigation. Of all of those, I think anthropologists feel most the need for integration. And the field is rather limited, and in terms of numbers who work in it. Soviet Union has a huge scientific apparatus working in the circumpolar area. And their structure seems to be much more integrative than ours. And, of course, it's all government-sponsored. Our research is very individualistic, and that is one of those things. And I welcome the initiative that came out of University of Alaska Natural Sciences departments for a policy decision at the federal level in Congress as for an Arctic research policy in the United States. I think it's a great step forward, and I hope it will be implemented so that there is a little bit more coordination, that people are more aware of the research in their geographic area done in sister disciplines and so on.
I interviewed on this show a few months ago visiting Professor Louis Ray, and of course, his interest is also in putting the scientific and economic and so on, all the things that
and
affect
social.
Us and social together. And we were talking about, if you're not looking at a globe, but if you're looking at an atlas, the way they have to distort the world, the way they cut it up to make it fit on a flat piece of paper is to make that this circumpolar area look like it's very far apart because they have those odd jags in the map, and yet we are so close.
The polar ocean is Mediterranean of the north, and speaking of maps, it always irritates me when in class I have to use a map of Alaska, which ends at the eastern end of the Aleutian chain, so that I have to ask the students to exercise their imagination to move a sector of the map westward, but also I'm irritated because it doesn't show the relationship to the Kuril Island chain and to Japan, to the Japanese current, or to Kamchatka, and so that the relationship in terms of geographical distances and sailing opportunities is not fully understood by looking just at the map of Alaska.
We have a very different mental orientation because of our picture of things.
Exactly. And I like to bring in National Geographic's map of the polar ocean because they show it as it is, the Mediterranean of the north, except that they cut off the Aleutian chain.
Even they. Well, all of this is absolutely integral to a discussion that I certainly want us to have here. This one of the reasons, the special reasons for having you here on this date is that February 19th is the anniversary of FDR's signing of Executive Order 9066. And we got to the point where you had wanted to realize and actualize some of the research you'd been doing by visiting in person the Aleutian Chain. And I know from some bits of an interview that I heard you do before that when you arrived and met the people that lived there, one of the things that well, maybe I should back up and ask you what you did find there. What were your first impressions of? Which island did you go to first?
I went to Unalaska because this is the largest settlement. It's most accessible. It is the center for the eastern end of the chain. And it was historically, it is the site of the first Russian permanent stronghold. Not that I want to diminish Grigory Shelikhov's claim to fame for Three Saints Bay in 1984, but there was more or less permanent settlement established at Ilulug Bay in Unalaska in 1774, thereabouts, by Ivan Solovyov, who is remembered in Aleut folklore, not very flatteringly. And it was seemed a good place to start.
The Russians were, aside from the fact that they were just doing some exploring, they decided to settle there because of the fur trade.
Well, the fur traders operated in a certain pattern. Their expeditions lasted usually several years, so particular skippers had their favorite base where they took shelter, where there would be a good beach to beach the ship and winterize it. And after the 1764, roughly, there's a little bit of, you can make a historical argument when the war between the Aleuts in the in Unalaska and Umnak and the Russian fur skippers commenced at that time. After Solovyov and several other skippers clearly showed the Aleuts that they are the Russians are unbeatable. Solovyov established a permanent Russian outpost for the fur traders at Ilulug. Mm-hmm. About 1774 is the proposed date. Mm-hmm. And because of those historical associations, because the main Aleut Orthodox Church is there, and in 75 they celebrated the anniversary of the 150th anniversary of the founding of the church. Mm-hmm. So it seemed a good occasion to start.
And you arrived there. What was the population there approximately?
Oh, I don't remember the numbers.
I didn't bring my notes. No, that's okay. I didn't mean to catch you short, but is it a medium-sized town?
Unalaska, with its satellite Dutch harbor, is a major fishing port in the Pacific. So it is a very mixed population and very active one. In 75, it was cannery, crab fishery, and so on, floating canneries of all nations putting in, mm-hmm. and also some onshore canneries or tied to shore, Wakefield Cannery, several others, major canneries. Since then, there was a lot of building with the oil exploration in the Bering Sea. It is a center and a staging area for the oil industry. So the city continues to grow. It is a very major center. And the I'm sorry to say, but the Alit population is now in the minority.
Yes, with all of that going on, obviously it's a thriving, very mixed population now. There's also a military presence out there.
Not in Alaska.
But close by?
Not even close by. Okay. You have to understand Aleutian distances.
Okay.
We have to go to the Andrianov Islands and the central segment of the chain to Adak, and then, of course, in the westernmost end of the chain on Agatu, Atu, Shemi, and the near islands, their installations. But they, in no way do they impinge upon the eastern Aleutians.
Okay. Now we're going to go forward from that original Russian settlement to the time of World War II. The United States decided that obviously, as the war shifted and gained some focus on Japan, the military made a decision that strategically, either offensively or defensively, the Aleutian chain might become critical.
Yes.
And there was a very small military presence there prior to that awareness.
Yeah.
Is that correct?
And then there was a rapid build-up, as we all know, and I'm sure there are military historians who deal very competently with it. My understanding as a Johnny-come-lately and a civilian person who listens to civilians commenting that there has been some kind of a rivalry between the Army and the Navy as to handling of the whatever was happening militarily at the time in the Aleutians. And it is my impression that this might have been the contributing factor to what happened to the Aleut population. I don't know that I can document it from A to C, but certainly one is led to this inference that this disagreements between the Army and the Navy may have contributed to the disposal of Aleut population.
When that military presence, be it Army or Navy, started to build up, it was a fairly small Aleut population, but obviously one with deep traditions and...
Well, yes, the Aleut population was small in relation to, say, urban population of Alaska today. However, it was their home, and they were scattered in their ancestral villages. They were not as many villages on Unalaska Island alone as they were in 1867 when the United States took over Alaska. They were at that time many villages on Unalaska, which ceased to function sometime in between 1867 and 1890. However, they were Chernovsky village and Kashiga village on the Bering Sea side and the western end of Unalaska. There was Makushin village in Makushin Bay on the Bering Sea side. There was on the island of Bjorka, on the small island at the entry into Beaver Inlet, which is toward the Pacific on the eastern end of Unalaska, there was a very substantial village that in former times was very well organized and very affluent one. So only on this island, as you can see, in addition to Unalaska, there were five Aleut population center. They had different subsistence. They had different number of people living there. And, for example, Makushin was also very well organized, and they engaged in sheep herding. After the war, and when the Aleuts were returned from the relocation camps to Unalaska, they were not permitted to go anywhere. All of them were dumped at one center on Alaska. And there were, of course, squabbles about leadership, the sort of local citizenship rights, not very formal ones, but who has the say in the affairs.
Any tradition of long-standing. I understand that the citizens of Attu were not even allowed to return to Attu at all and were placed on an island that was a traditional rival.
Yes, they were placed on Atka, where they were strangers, even though that in the course of history, since the contact with Europeans, the common chain or Aleut identity was being forged, local distinctiveness remained, and the Atuans and the Atkins remembered that they used to be ancient enemies. Right now, the few survivors from Atu who remain in Atka through intermarriage and almost 40 years of residence are sort of integrated. But a lot of them left. Some went to Seattle and some Atuans left, went to Anchorage because they just didn't want to stay in Atka.
Okay, acknowledging that neither of us are experts on military decision-making, or and certainly I'm not even someone who has amateur knowledge of it. There were many things, many communications that went back and forth between government agencies. At that time, Alaska was under the Department of Interior. Is that correct?
Yes.
And Ernest Greening was the territorial governor.
Yes.
And as the war in the Pacific was increasing, there were discussions made about what to do about the indigenous native population that was on these islands.
Yes, yes. Quite a lot of the discussions with initially when I encountered the problem and started my research into this at requests of some friends in Alaska, I tended to blame General Simon Bolivar Bruckner because I sort of said, well, he did it. And I found that on the contrary, he was a staunch supporter of the notion that the Aleut should be left alone in their ancestral villages where they can, even that if the Japanese would arrive, if the Aleuts escaped immediate capture, they could survive by their aboriginal methods of procuring subsistence. And he was staunchly against evacuation.
Okay, these are people that have lived in comparative isolation for countless generations.
That is right.
And who have had very successful subsistence existence in a very harsh environment.
That is true. If push came to shove, they probably would have survived on their own.
In fact, one island was taken by the Japanese.
It was.
And for a while, they allowed the Aleuts to go. Which island was that?
That was the island of Attu.
Attu. And they allowed the citizens to go about their normal life for a while, but later on they were removed to a concentration or to a camp in Japan.
They were evacuated to Hokkaido, is my understanding. Yeah. And Dr. Henry Stewart, an American by origin who is now teaching at the university in Japan, and I understand he's now a Japanese citizen, he did some research for the Aleuts on the Japanese captivity. To my knowledge, this material hasn't been published, but it is available. It is on record.
Is it safe to say that some of the confusion about whether to evacuate the Aleuts in advance of any known attack, whether to leave them there, where to evacuate them, had something to do with also their military confusion about not knowing exactly what they were going to use the area for? I know that there were several military activities planned and then weather interfered and they weren't able to make the landings and so on.
I really don't know. I think at least among some of the people, there was this, let's not have those strange-looking civilians underfoot to interfere in any way, shape, or manner. while General Bruckner liked those strange-looking civilians because he thought they would be excellent guides and could really assist the military in because they knew the environment so well. So I think there might have been some disagreements about the role of civilians that are left in a zone that is being built up as a military base.
I think one of the confusions I had in reading some of this material is that because it's, relatively speaking, a fairly small population that we're talking about at that time, it was real hard for me to understand why better arrangements were not formulated.
It is difficult for me to understand. You see, at Atka, where the only non-Aleut people were the couple who were teachers at school, they were evacuated. But at Unalaska, non-Aleut population was not evacuated, even the civilians. So it is very difficult for me to understand why a non-Aleut civilian was not in danger or all right, and the Aleut civilian was.
Well, partly the explanation that is offered a little bit in the chapter of the book, the report by the commission, which is called Personal Justice Denied, is that different agencies in Washington, presumably, and some had their bureaucratic headquarters in Chicago and so on, these instructions were coming from a variety of places, had jurisdiction over different parts of the population. And they were saying that that order, perhaps one of the reasons why a Caucasian man who was married to an Aleut woman, he was left and she was taken away, was because it was the Organization of Indian Affairs that gave that particular order.
That is very possible.
And maybe not racially motivated, but...
Well, I am here very prejudiced. I think that a lot of bureaucrats in the Organization of Indian Affairs at that time, not the head of the agency, Collier, that a lot of lower-level bureaucrats were very, very paternalistic, overbearing, and yes, racist. What I was going to say is that... when I read the report of the United States Commission on the Wartime Relocation and Internment of Civilians, again and again I find remarks to the extent that some bureaucrats were afraid that if they don't evacuate the Aleuts, they might be criticized. And this is the reasoning, the bureaucratic reasoning that I find most obnoxious, because it is not concerned with the welfare of the people affected most, but the reputation of an agency. And I'm too committed to be impartial on this.
Well, actually, the government report, in fact, to some extent verifies that opinion. It seemed that in a lot of the discussion, the issue was not whether harm would come to the citizens, but whether it would be spectacular harm by a bomb in a military action versus slow illness or something that wouldn't be so likely to capture headlines, that they were really interested in how the press would view this and how other people might take their actions.
But I can't understand, not being privy to all the decision-making that was on, why the original plan that Governor Gruning, if I remember correctly, and General Bruckner discussed, that if the evacuation is necessary from the sections of the chain that are likely to be exposed, to place the Aleuts in Aleut villages on Alaska Peninsula and Unimak Island or in the Shumagins, why this plan was abandoned and they were herded into those abandoned canneries without any kind of heat, water supply, sanitary facilities, cooking facilities, and so on.
Yeah, they were taken to an environment that was very different than their own, when, in fact, we have a lot of space in the Aleutian chain.
Whoever it was, and they had kinship connections and so on, whoever it was who came up with the original plan at least was concerned with the realities of the situation and the needs of the people. Why that plan was abandoned, I still don't know. And I read the report. I don't know why it was changed and by whom.
One of the things that struck you when you first went there is that the people that you met and grew to love said, we know what happened to us during the war, but we want other people to know. And you said that you slowly went about, because you do know the channels, trying to document some of the occurrences. And this brings us to one of the real frustrations, is that the documentation is a real uneven. I mean, it's sort of confusing to me when this government report is done. I assume that these people had access to a great number of records, and yet it is very incomplete. There's lots of unanswered questions.
Well, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, after the war, ordered the National Archive Repository in Seattle to destroy the records of Attune Saga. For what reason, I don't know, except that there is a record that, by the order of the agency that owned the documents, those were destroyed. I believe I was told they were sold as used paper to fishmongers on the wharf. Also, we could not locate the records of the Organization of Indian Affairs pertaining to the evacuation and relocation and repatriation. The most of the documents that survived were kept by the officials responsible for the Pribilof sealing operation, which was a different department of the Interior at the time. And those people preserved their records, and that is the bulk of the documentation. Now, this documentation has been analyzed, and every scrap that could be found has been found by the attorney for the Aleuts, John Kirkland, with a very prestigious firm in Washington, D.C., and it comprises 12 bound volumes.
All right, let's back up for the sake of our audience, because we just have to assume that not everybody is aware of all the aspects of this. Although, I mentioned earlier in the show that FDR signed Executive Order 9066 on February 19th. And although the situation of the Aleuts was very different than the Japanese internment, which was occurring especially along the West Coast at that time, and this executive order addresses the internment of Japanese civilians on our coast, that same order was used to move the Aleuts. And although I guess we've made it clear here for our audience that it's not clear to us why there were a great many discussions about the best thing to do with the Aleut population for their own safety, much of this conversation was between Greening and Bruckner and so on, was based on how will the Aleuts fare best. But at any rate, between all of these agencies, and despite the fact that the Aleuts themselves had some inkling that they might be moved, or there was some discussion on in some villages that they might be asked to move, move to another place. In fact, when they finally were, they had very, very short notice.
Well, my understanding is that the order was implemented by the Navy, and one would have to find the officers in charge and interview them to find out how they interpreted it. But if they got this famous executive order for their guidelines, then of course they would act in accordance with it, and that would explain the hardship of the actual removal, the very short time given to get ready, no warning to speak of, no personal possessions, only bedding and clothing.
One suitcase per person,
and no personal possessions whatsoever.
Right. No cooking utensils, no equipment that they might have needed to fish, if presumably if they'd been in a place that they could have used
their
traditional skills.
If I might interject, you see, while Bruckner and Gruning were familiar with the situation and they discussed it in terms of realities and their knowledge of the Aleuts and so on and so forth, the Navy had none of that. The Navy just stepped in. And as I say, if they got a piece of paper which contained this order, they implemented it. And as you mentioned, it was the order that was concerned with potential enemy aliens.
So here is an Aleut population that is being treated as if they're potential enemies, although the intent, at least we have to assume so, was to get them out of harm's way and out of the middle of a military action, which wasn't clear to how extensive that military action would be.
Yeah. That is true. And it is my inference that a lot of it has to do that the Navy was given the responsibility on the basis of a piece of paper, and the Navy had very little contact with the local situation, and they just went ahead.
And my understanding is that the local population was not consulted on what their wishes were, certainly not informed consent.
But if the Navy was guided by the executive order on the relocation of and internment of civilians, the Navy would not dream of consulting the local population.
Correct. Okay. And here we start the part of the story that's just really painful for any caring citizen, hopefully of the United States and certainly of Alaska, to hear, because these people who had been isolated from disease to some extent and certainly led a very rugged and hard life but very different conditions in their life than what now happened. They were herded onto ships with one suitcase, one blanket, had to leave behind their homes, their churches, all of their possessions, their artifacts, their culture, and onto the boat and moved to these deserted canneries in the southeast.
Well, I would like to mention the village of Atka, where the situation was much worse, while in other villages they simply were required to abandon their home. At Atka, while the villagers were going about their subsistence activity, the Navy commander in charge fired the village. Their homes were burned with all their possessions inside, and also the historic church in Atka was burned to the ground, including the contents, which had extensive community records, all the vital statistics, all the daily copies of the correspondence of the parish priests since 1828. We have part of it survives in the clean copies that were sent to the bishopric, but the local record went up in smoke, including some of the artwork, because the Chapel of Transfiguration from Amelia Island was transferred in the late 1800s to Atka, and we do know that the iconostasy there and the icons were painted by the first priest on Atka, who himself was an Aleut, whose mother was probably an Atkan, who grew up in St. George and was the first native Alaskan priest of the Orthodox Church. He was an icon painter, and some of his artwork went up in smoke. The bells that were cast probably in the 18th century in Siberia were melted in the fire, were damaged beyond repair. In short, irreplaceable treasures were lost, and I have in my mind the question, was it necessary to set fire to the village, especially when we know the two houses with internal plumbing were left intact?
The military justification at that time being that they expected a Japanese invasion to be imminent, and they didn't want to leave habitable dwellings to make Japanese occupation easier.
An hour and two to let the people to take out their most personal treasures, their icons, that probably dated from the 18th century.
In fact, the account I read of that said that the native population had been sent out to their camps, their hunting or fishing camps, because they were afraid the village would be bombed, and the village was burnt, intentionally,
By the Navy.
Before they could return. And
that's
so
right.
There was absolutely no opportunity at all to remove anything that might have had personal meaning to them.
That's right.
And given the long, when one reads this, the long chronology involved here, it doesn't seem, at least in the documentation, that we're talking a sort of critical minute-by-minute time frame. So it's very hard to see the urgency and the speed when they'd been deliberating for so many months about what they were going to do there.
Well, certainly. And in the Pribilofs, which is the best documented part of the said saga, one of my friends said that the saddest thing that she remembers is the cattle that they were leaving behind, the milk cows that haven't been milked, lowing in pain.
Sad. What they found when they got off the ships were deserted canneries in the southeast, several different locations depending on.
Some were better than others, but none of them were really what we would expect citizens taken out of a dangerous zone. For their own good to be exposed to. The especially bad conditions were at Funter Bay, where the Pribilovians were housed from St. Paul and St. George. This was really very bad situation.
Terrible health conditions resulted.
Correct.
The population had a high incidence of tuberculosis. Influenza.
They also had an epidemic of measles that struck them.
That their population had not previously been exposed to?
Well, I imagine they were previously exposed to, but this took a dreadful toll.
We have whole families living in very small areas which are only separated from other families by a blanket. So the contagion obviously has great opportunity to spread quickly.
And there was also very poor health care. The conditions were not conducive to it. It was cold. There was no running water. The bathroom facilities were non-existent. You had to dig trenches and so on and so forth. What interests me is that I came across a little bit of correspondence. An Aleut woman and her daughter got a job in the town of Juna, and they were telling their employer about the conditions in the camp, and the employer was appalled. And I don't remember if she or her daughter went to look for herself. And she wanted to expose this. And they were going to get the then flourishing New York Herald Tribune correspondent in. And there is correspondence saying that we can stop this by invoking the wartime censorship powers. So you see, this is one of those things where some law level bureaucrat invokes the powers over the press granted to preserve national security to squelch information leaking out to the public on the abominable conditions in the camps. This is one of those things that I say every nation has good, bad, and indifferent.
There was a lot of trouble getting, I think, first, probably because, as you say, specifically these camps were being dealt with by lower-level bureaucrats. But on a whole list of priorities, obviously these people and their welfare were very low on that list.
Oh, correspondence of Secretary Ikes and even of Roosevelt himself, the little that he bothered, they were just of no consequence. very, they were too little, too small, too
very
too
much
few.
A very patronizing attitude is just comes through all of the documentation here, and very often in the correspondence there seems to be a very condescending attitude toward the people, as if you can't talk to them as normal people and treat them like children. You know, we'll make decisions for them.
Well, I guess your generation does not realize how far we have come, how much the attitudes have changed. And they did change, but you're right. They were treated as incompetent to deal with the problems themselves, to understand their situation. And today we find it astonishing. But 40 years ago, it was the rule.
Case in point is the way that men who were involved in the fur industry, the seal fur harvest, at the time were really treated, well, I can't think of a better word, treated. That industry was, the seal harvest at that time was around 171,000 seals in 43 or something like that, and it was a significant amount of money, which the majority of which went to the American government.
True.
And, of course, once the adult male population had been removed from the islands, the fur population, there was one year when they did not have those fur harvesters back where there was virtually no harvest.
And the Elliott men were ordered back to this danger zone to kill seals because the government was not going to lose the profits from sealing that year. They tried to refuse. They tried to go on strike. They were threatened with consequences if they refused to return.
Yes, and I think we must share with the audience what those consequences were. I don't know from the documentation if it was ever officially condoned, but the real verbal threat that was clearly communicated to the Aleuts was that we have the power to deny you future return. If
yes.
you do not do this for us, you will never be allowed to go back to your home.
Yes, and also they were threatened that guns will be used to force them. I don't know if that appears in the documentation, but the threat was made manifest. I don't know that actual guns were shown, but the threat of using guns was
certainly a very intimidating atmosphere.
Yeah.
Also, under certain interpretations of the law, at first it was considered that the Aleuts were under our protection of some sort, and so therefore were not draftable. But they changed that interpretation around.
Yes, because you see, by the Treaty of Transfer of Sovereignty from Imperial Russia to the United States, the Aleuts were supposed to become full citizens, and so they became. It depended on who read the law. And they became draftable, and a lot of the young Aleuts volunteered. And the irony is that I know several persons who were pulled out of from the army from their duties to be sent to the Pribilofs to kill seals for that particular season.
Yes. That is documented also. That was the best way they could serve their country, was to leave their unit and go back and enjoy the fruits of the seal harvest.
As I say, it depended on who read the law and then how he or she interpreted the law. I think it's mostly he's.
When you look at this, these elements together, they certainly didn't have free will at the time. They were placed in these camps, supposedly for their own protection, but really their freedom and what they did, I mean, it's a small number. It would have seemed like one option could have been that they would have been integrated into already existing populations and allowed to work and to...
Not at
but
all.
But that was not ever considered as a possibility.
No.
They were left in these camps for a long time. For several years, way beyond the time that there was any actual military action occurring out there.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And I guess one thing that we have to say is that the number of casualties, the mortality rate in those camps was very high.
Yes, that is true.
due to illness and poor medical treatment and poor health care. And I guess they were fed on army rations, but in the first-hand accounts, they talk about how they had very all of their normal foods they were denied, and of course not very much fresh produce or so they were really living on army rations at the time, and that probably also contributed when they're used to very high protein diet.
Yes, the food was strange. The atmosphere was oppressive. I know, for example, a friend of mine who has grandchildren here at the university, she doesn't like to come to visit here. She can't stand it. She can't hear the ocean, and the trees depress her. But I have just come across here in the commission's report that Aleuts had to ask the resident agents permission before they could leave the camp. And so on and so forth. Certainly, it was an interference with our basic right of free movement.
That is extremely clear. Now, in the consideration of reparation, let's see, what are we reading here? I want to go to the hearings that have been done. I think that they probably first started around out of a desire of the American Japanese for some kind of reparation of the loss that they suffered during that time that they were kept in camps. They lost their businesses. Many of them lost certainly any capacity to earn money during that time. And so the government has been having hearings to consider what kind of reparation will be made. And the Aleuts, because they suffered under the same executive order, have also been considered in that reparation, but very unequally.
Well, the inequality comes from the fact that Aleuts have different attitudes themselves to what the reparations should consist of. While the Japanese are pushing for recompense to individuals or their descendants who have suffered, the Aleuts are more concerned about their losses as a community. It is very difficult for them to estimate the value of the possessions that they have lost. A lot of their possessions, like what price, the icons and various personal belongings or a guitar or whatever, it's very difficult to place a value on. But they are very conscious about the harm that their community has suffered, so that the recommendations of the commission reflect it. And my understanding is that they have recommended for a small token compensation to individuals who survive, a fund that would be used for cultural activities within the Aleutian communities, and also restoration of their churches. That was one of the sticking points in the House last year on the basis of, isn't that violation of separation of church and state? And yet it...
Well, when the state's responsible for the destruction of the church or the agents of the state...
But with the Marshall Plan, some of the churches in Europe destroyed during the war were renovated as historical monuments. Those Aleut churches are historic.
Yeah, I think we need to clearly make this point. It says in the report, and I quote, "The loss of a generation of village elders has had a cultural impact far beyond the grief and pain to their own families. Among those who died were most of the last people on earth who knew the old Aleut ways, how to make the skin boats, traditional clothing, or local styles of basketry."
That is correct.
And although I'm sure there are those that would argue that white impact or the changes that were about to happen in Alaska, the coming of statehood and so on, would have irrevocably impacted the Aleut culture in any case, certainly it would have not impacted it in the way that
The evacuation did.
Being forced to absolutely leave everything. And one of the things that I guess we haven't hit on...
The point was that we talked about high mortality. The age groups were the very young and the very old. Those are the ones who went first.
One, because they're more vulnerable to really devastating effects of influenza and so on. And also it was really pointed out that just the stress, having lived their whole lives in a very, very different atmosphere under very different conditions, made them fighting, their physical fighting for their health and surviving some of these epidemics was just much more difficult.
Many suffered extreme psychological stress. We'll never see our homeland again. This is the end.
And the other thing that happened is that the American military troops that occupied some of their villages, I'm sure that to them this is just an oddity. It's such a foreign culture. The habitations, the churches, everything were so foreign to them. And there was a lot of vandalism and desecration.
Looting, as if,
aside from the issue we talked about where there was a military decision made to burn the whole village, but in many other cases where the homes had been locked, they're just destroyed.
I don't know how true it is. I have no reason to doubt the word of Vern Robinson. He is very aged. He lives in Alaska. He was formerly United States Marshal. He told me that at one point a commissary officer in Alaska decided that the historic church, which is today a National Historic Landmark on the National Register, it is one of the most important historical sites in all Alaska, that it would be just the thing for an officer's club. And Vern told me that he had to go and push his way into the commanding general's presence and fight not to have this happen.
Our perspectives as individuals are so different, and the way we interpret something and its meaning is so different as a result. The hearings about reparation are still going on. The KUAC has done a documentary special entitled Personal Justice Denied about the Aleut evacuation, forced evacuation. And one of the women says, how do we value so much lost 40 years ago? How do you put a figure on that? How do I know how to tell you what that is worth, how my life would have been different if that hadn't happened? And I guess that's what we're faced to look at. And I think I'd also like to address, before we run out of time, the fact that we do extra insult if we don't acknowledge that this did happen. As deeply embarrassing and as painful as this is for us to admit, we must admit that it happened to them and that they had very little choice about it and that their culture has had an irreversible negative impact from this evacuation. And I think that the one thing we can do if we can't solve it here is at least acknowledge it.
If I may say one more thing, there is a building in Alaska called Bishop's House that the Alaska State Office of History and Archaeology was helping renovate. It is a marvelous, architecturally beautiful structure. The funds have been running out, so I don't know how the interior restoration has proceeded, but that building, the Aleut's Hope, if the reparations are voted, and if this cultural fund is established, that it will become a regional museum of Aleut culture. And I hope that this is going to come to pass.
I hope so, too. I thank you very much for sharing this really important piece of Alaskan history, regrettable Alaskan history, with us. I hope some more people who are in our listening audience know a little bit more about it than they did. It has been my distinct pleasure to spend this past hour with you, Dr. Lydia Black, and I hope everyone has a nice weekend and a good week. I've been your host, Patty Kostelic, and our executive producer is Carla Tonella.